Why get all your holiday decorations delivered through Instacart? Because maybe you only bought two wreaths, but you have 12 windows. Or maybe your toddler got very eager with the advent calendar. Or maybe the inflatable snowman didn't make it through the snowstorm. Or maybe the twinkle lights aren't twinkling. Whatever the reason, this season, Instacart's here for hosts and their whole holiday haul. Get decorations from the Home Depot, CVS, and more through Instacart and enjoy free delivery on your first three orders. Service fees and terms apply.
For the past three seasons of Gone South, we've covered one story per season. Now, Gone South is back for a fourth season. But this time, we're doing things a little differently. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
#614, some rain around. I do this every Veterans Day. You can text the name of your veteran in your family or your own, if you like, to me on the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and text line 504-260-1870, and I'll pass them along and thank everybody for their service. Happy Veterans Day to my son Ryan. He was a Marine. My daughter Ashley was in the Army. My name is Peter. I was Navy, of a military family. Chuck Dame, United States Marine Corps. Lee Ogborn, Jen Ogborn, Navy. Al Green, Army paratrooper, 1966. Sergeant Eugene Oquan, USMC, 1963, deceased. Master Sergeant Bob Currie, U.S. Air Force, 35 years of service, 3 years and two tours in Vietnam. My son Justin Parker, Navy veteran. My little sister Kiosha White, Air Force veteran. Dad Erwin Parker, senior Army veteran. My grandfather Walter III, an Army veteran. Staff Sergeant Matt Greer, USAF, 6 years of service. Thank y'all for your service, and keep sending them in. And I'll be glad to acknowledge the veterans and the service on this Veterans Day, Monday, November 11th. Mike Dettelier joins us now. Mike, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you, Thomas.
Merry Rizzimus.
Merry Rizzimus.
Yeah, because it really was a difference yesterday. Tell me your impressions, first of all, about what you saw yesterday.
You showed some heart, some emotion, some grit, and you weren't bad and boring.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Not everything was right, and you flawed as a football team. But you showed some excitement, and you played hard. I think for most fans, okay, you want to win.
Mm-hmm.
That's paramount. But you want to see a team play hard and play with some excitement and some emotion. You saw that yesterday. You saw the emotion of a football team. And, you know, once things started to go right for you, the crowd got into it. They were backing you 100%. And so you saw, you know, again, some of the good angles. You saw the flaws this team had. But, you know, against a hated rival, you were able to win. But I think it was the effort, Tommy, more than anything,
mm-hmm.
that we hadn't seen this, say, in 7 weeks, probably in five of the seven. You really didn't see this from this football team. And it almost was like 7 months instead of 7 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw it yesterday. You saw this team play with passion, emotion, and grit, that they were determined they were going to find a way to win.
Number 32, every time I see him miss a tackle, every time I think he's done, Mike, every time he comes up with a big play.
He's not as great as he once was, but boy, every once in a while,
yep.
he shows you just who he can be. And that's the part of being an older player in this league. You're going to miss not being around teammates and winning and being in an atmosphere that you're never going to be around again. Once you leave that locker room,
mm-hmm.
that there's not going to be people you closer to than your teammates. But he was special. And as you get older, Jimmy Taylor told me this years ago, as you know, I think God sort of tricks you, because at times you can sort of touch the magic you once had, but you can't do it all the time. Mm-hmm. And he said, that's when I knew, you know, I had to leave the game, when I couldn't do it consistently. But he said, you know, I think God sort of teases you that every once in a while you can do it. It's just not like you could do it before. But, man, that was big for Tyron yesterday to come up with, you know, plays. Interception seems to always have this innate ability to put himself in a position to make a play.
Talk about, if you will, I'm thinking Kirk Cousins, and it's not Kirk Cousins. I'm having a moment here. Derek Carr and the difference we saw in Derek Carr.
Well, he was efficient. He didn't turn the ball over. Again, you see the rocky ride with him, good and bad. And you see it all in sometimes in one series. You see the really good and the really inconsistent all in one series. But you know, he was efficient yesterday. That, I think, is the best term for it. And you saw he does something very well. He throws the deep pass. And, okay, Marquez, God bless him, he is who he is. Mm-hmm. He's got great size. He could run like a deer. The problem has been passes like that you saw him make yesterday. He makes them in one game, and then he'll drop two the next. That's why he's bounced from Green Bay to Kansas City to Buffalo to New Orleans. But you saw Derek. I mean, he put that ball right where it had to be. And, you know, then the frustrating part, he puts one out there for Kamara, who's wide open.
That,
and
look.
And, you, and so, listen, there's not a player in this league that has not touched the ball as many times, sort of say, as a starter would over a course of time, that hasn't dropped the ball like that.
You know what that proved to me, Mike? You know what my takeaway from that was? My God, he's human. I didn't think he was, but he's a human being after all. He can make a mistake, Alvin Kamara. You can't criticize him for that, man. That was just a human mistake. It happens, like you're saying. Every player has done it. It's. I'm glad it didn't take any of the shine off of his day becoming the Saints' leading rusher. But I think if you're going to talk about one of the best players Saints ever had, you got to put 41 in the conversation, don't you think?
Oh, no question. From a Saints standpoint, and you know, he's one of the best running backs in the NFL. You saying what you said reminds me, and he coached in the NFL and major college football over 50 years. And he was a neighbor of mine for so long. He passed away a couple years ago, Joe Clark. Mm-hmm. And Joe had never really watched television. And he sees this Seinfeld episode of this gal was heckling Jerry during one of his comedy acts. And then Jerry turns the table's on her, and he goes heckle her at work. Mm-hmm. And Joe was like, Mike, I would love to do that to these fans that get on me for bad play calling or whatever. Let me go to their workplace just one day.
Put you under a microscope, right? Everything you do.
Let me see how you feel, every little thing. And it was just his passion with it, because he had coached for so long. And, man, he's heard everything thrown at him. And so,
Mike,
I
would take it a step further. I would say, you know what? Not only am I going to watch you at work, I'm going to go back and watch how you prepare to come to work. Right?
And that was the funniest line coming from him, because he really wasn't a super serious guy. But he really wasn't, I say, television lit. He didn't watch TV. He listened to WWL radio. You know, it was sort of weird to hear him say it, because he had never brought up television to me.
Yeah.
Never.
It resonated
and to watch
him.
That one episode, and that stuck with him, and he was like, I would love to do it. And he said, listen, they pay their money, they can boo and whatever. That's fine. But the heckling part
right.
of some people take it to another limit, and the first thing you're going to read, they always got some smart aleck. Oh, yeah, but he could have made this play.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mike, we got to take a break.
I'll go back.
Let me pick it up when we come back, all right?
Go ahead, Barry.
He could have made this play. We'll pick it up when we come back. Mike's going to be second guessing with Bobby Hebert, Silver Slipper tonight. Mike's got a long day. We appreciate him getting up early. 6:23 traffic now, WWL. 6:28, Tommy Tucker, WWO, a couple of minutes for the news. Back with Mike Dettelier, then he'll be back with us after the news. Mike, Derek Carr just, man, puzzles me how you can drop it in a bucket or, like Bobby said, drop it in a well. And then the next play just seemingly, I don't understand that. And I don't recall a quarterback that played like that in the NFL. Do you?
Oh, there's plenty of them. It's the inconsistency.
But I mean, that
you
to be able to drop it in a well like that, but then the next play look like you're a rookie. I don't.
Okay, if you watch the Seattle Seahawks, you know it's like that, Geno Smith.
Okay.
He's the exact same guy.
That's a good point.
That he can make that great play, and then he's inconsistent. And I think you got to give guys like that a lot of credit. You've got to be able, as we were talking about before, being able to shake off something bad, and then, hey, you got another play, get back out there.
Mm-hmm.
Because in life, a lot of people can't do that, Tommy.
That's right.
They can't shake off something bad. It stays with them. And you saw it with Derek, and sometimes you see it all in one series. Him very good, him pretty good, he's not good. And so that's just his makeup as a quarterback. Not everybody's going to be Pat Mahomes, okay?
Mike,
that's
you know what?
Or Josh Allen.
As you
or
say
Joe Burrow.
That, as you say that, you just helped me because you know what? That's who he is, and to expect that all of a sudden he is going to be Josh Allen or Pat Mahomes, it's not going to happen. Derek Carr is who he is, so we as fans, and this is no disrespect to Derek Carr at all, we have to manage our expectations based on that and know what to expect every week going into a game, that's going to be him and that's the way number four is going to play. You should be a psychologist.
Absolutely.
You just help me out, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You bet.
I'm going to send you the bill in the mail.
Well, you got to go through the insurance first. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up with Mike. We come back right now. Time for WWL First News. 6:44, 16 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL. It was just a different feel today, a different feel yesterday in the Dome, a different look. It looked, Mike, like the Saints of old, not the Saints of old, like they had been looking. That makes sense to you.
Yeah, it makes sense. No, again, they played with excitement and emotion and grit, and that's what you want. Now here becomes a little bit more difficult part. Can you carry it over and it became consistent? We all know this team has flaws in it.
Mm-hmm.
But can you overcome that? And sometimes you need a little bit of football luck, and you got it yesterday. When Koo misses three field goals, that sucker, when he plays against the Saints, he's never missed no field goals. And he misses three yesterday.
When he missed three, you knew that the Saints were going to win.
Yeah, something's not right, NK, you got it. Yeah. But the thing is, the carryover to this now, the emotion to carry this over, because that wide receiver, I mean, you sort of been wiped out because of not having Chris Olave, not having Rashid Shaheed. Hopefully, pretty soon you'll get back Eric McCoy. You can see that they're not great stopping the run. Atlanta ran the football at them, and I still don't understand why they didn't do it more. Just keep pounding away at it. But can you keep this going? So to speak. And it's not all going to be wins. But I think for people, if you give in great effort and you play with that type of emotion, hey, you're not bad and you're not boring. And I think they want to see excitement and a certain energy and a certain toughness from this football team. You saw it yesterday.
How does Coach Rizzi maintain it?
Well, if I knew that, Tommy, we'd think you'd make a lot of money doing it.
Let me take a step back from that, Mike. And here's the thing. You know, I heard Tyrann Mathieu talk about he knows how to motivate us. I know people say, you know, you're a pro, you should motivate yourself. Everything you do is on tape. I get all of that. Motivating yourself to file a report in the Higginsby account is different than when you're in the trenches and getting a snot beat out of you and you're exhausted. I understand all of that. But I'm just going to say it. Dennis Allen had to feel terrible yesterday, I would think, because it was apparent, right? I mean,
it was apparent that they had tuned him out.
Yeah.
I think there was no question, Tommy, that they had tuned him out for whatever, because that locker room is sort of sacred. It's run by the players. It's not run by the coaches. It's run by the players. Whatever happened there, you could see they had clicked the channel on him. They had, okay, you can talk all you want, but it's not, I'm not listening mm-hmm. to what you're saying. Yesterday, you saw a team that seemed to be much more in tune with the coach, with the head coach. They bought into what he was trying to sell. The hardest thing in coaching is to be able to do that over a course of time. That's the trick to coaching altogether, of you being able to sell what you are delivering to your players. It's a really fine line, especially at that level. None of this high school or college stuff.
I guess what confuses me is that to turn it around like that in a week, and look, it was only one game, I get that, okay? But against a pretty good team, and you did get a lot of luck with Wu missing his three field goals, which they tell me hasn't happened all the way through college, three in a game. One unblocked, of course. That you can't blame that on him, I guess. But I guess the point I'm making is, how does a guy that comes in as the interim coach turn it around in a week, and when as a player I'm saying, you're not going to be here anyway, maybe not. It's all about, and I knew beforehand, even with Dennis Allen, it was about what I put on tape and people analyzing the way I played on the field. You see the disconnect there where I don't get it?
Okay, this is the big part of it. Rizzi's been there years. So he knows kind of every player's button to press. Because when you're the special teams coach, mm-hmm. you have dealings with everybody, one way or another. And I think if you have that type of talent to be able to connect with somebody, you can hit the right button. Again, can you do it again and again and again? That's the part of coaching that's difficult. But I think his connection to the team, Tommy, for years, and he knew those players, and he knew what they do very good and what they don't do very good. I think that was sort of the emphasis here. Let's not worry about what you can't do. Let's worry about what you can do good. I think that got lost in the translation with Dennis Allen. I think it got lost. I think he was more emphasizing what you're doing wrong mm-hmm. than what you can do right.
That makes a lot of sense. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. All right, 6:56, 4 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Mike Dettelier. Mike, I was doing some errands, went to get some new kicks, as the kids say. And I was listening to you and Herb on Saturday. I'll do a great job with that pregame show. You really
do. Thank you. Appreciate it.
I didn't know at the time that was going to be the highlight of the day. I'm going to talk to Jeff Palermo next half hour about LSU. You got thoughts on that?
Well, I said it in the pregame. LSU's a flawed football team. And I'm not sure which LSU team shows up week to week. Mm-hmm. And that's the most dangerous sort of team. Because you can play very well, or you can play like you did Saturday. It's an El Stinko game. And they were out-coached. outplayed, out-hustled. Alabama came there almost like a business trip. We're taking care of business and we're going back home. LSU looked as though for 2 weeks, you know, they kind of took it easy. And I know that's not the case.
No, I know.
But it almost seemed to be that way. And you wanted the crowd to get involved. But what are they going to do? You can't clap for nothing or holler for nothing. They put you away for stuff like that. I know Alabama came to play, and Jalen Milroe was spectacular against LSU. And he has been 2 years in a row. So there's some issues there with Brian. And I'm just telling you, I think there's a certain disconnect with him and that football team of getting his message across.
Alabama was pitching and LSU was catching. I'll leave it at that. When it comes to the Saints, how would you determine the rest of the season to be successful? You know, I don't get crazy here. You know, maybe something happens. They luck in a playoff spot. Maybe not. Probably not. But for people that are saying, you know, go ahead and tank the season, get the draft choice, the first thing I would say was, well, what have you dumped the draft choice so far? Secondly, you need to evaluate, and you don't want to enshrine a culture of losing, do you?
No, you don't. And the people that say tank it, okay? My thing is, you tell your boss you tank it when you go to work? Do you tell your boss, mm-hmm, I'm going to tank it today and next week and the next? Okay, you know what's going to happen with you? They're going to tank you right out of the door. And players don't want to put bad tape out there. If you want to continue playing in the NFL, my thing is, you play hard. You play with passion. You play with emotion. That's what people want you to play with. They know that you're not going to win every game. And you're not going to – these games aren't always going to be close. But they want to see some passion from this football team. Because, you know, all of us who cover it are fans. We flawed too. Mm-hmm. We have our deficiencies too. But if you do it in a certain manner, out on that football field, and it's always there. It's always going to stick in that mind, certain events that, you know what, he could have really not played today, but he is. Look at Kamara. Mm-hmm. Look at all the injuries he's had, and he's still out there.
Yep.
Taysom Hill, the exact same thing.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it as always. We'll be listening for you this afternoon when you and Bobby second guest at the Silver Slipper on the beach, Hancock County, Mississippi. They'll talk to Nicholls head coach Tim Rebo at 5:40, 6:30. You got a choice. Pelicans versus the Nets on 870 AM or the Saints Coaches Show with Darren Rizzi, an offensive line coach John Benson with Mike Haas and the Cajun Cannon on 105.3 in the Odyssey app. We take a break, come back, talk to Jeff Palermo about LSU here on WWE.
I'm Jed Lipinski. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Why get all your holiday decorations delivered through Instacart? Because maybe you only bought 2 wreaths, but you have 12 windows. Or maybe your toddler got very eager with the advent calendar. Or maybe the inflatable snowman didn't make it through the snowstorm. Or maybe the twinkle lights aren't twinkling. Whatever the reason, this season, Instacart's here for hosts and their whole holiday haul. Get decorations from the Home Depot, CVS, and more through Instacart and enjoy free delivery on your first 3 orders. Service fees and terms apply.
WL. 7:16 now on this Veterans Day. I rarely do this, but I had to turn the game off and go to bed in the third quarter because it was like watching somebody get chewed out at work. It was just embarrassing for everybody, and I didn't feel the need to be part of that. Jeff Palermo joins us now, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How you doing?
I thought about a couple of movies as I was watching. First was Jaws, in that for Governor Landry, I thought, we're going to need a bigger liver tiger than we have now. And the other thing is when I saw Jalen Milroe running down the field, I swear to God, it looked like Forrest Gump in that movie. It looked like Tom Hanks in Forrest Gump, didn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't pretty at all. It really wasn't. And, you know, Jalen Milroe just – he had his way with LSU. I mean, the Tigers had no answer for it. And it was very disappointing. It was something that it was obviously the big concern. And I know LSU put together a game plan and they talked about it and they spent time for 2 weeks doing it. But I think, Tommy, it just comes down to the fact they don't have the players on defense to obviously stop a running quarterback. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can scheme it, they can game plan it, but the talent is just not there on the defensive side of the football. And on my last column for WWL.com, mm-hmm. I picked Alabama to win this game, and obviously I didn't expect it to be the margin that it was. I thought Alabama would win by a touchdown. I just thought in that second half of the Texas A&M game, some cracks in the foundation started to develop. Mm-hmm. And I thought Alabama can go into that game taking advantage of many of LSU's weaknesses, especially trying to stop the running quarterback. And Jalen Milroe is very, very good at it. Very good at it. And LSU just doesn't have the horses to try to stop someone like that is, you know, as big as him, as fast as him. And it was, I mean, LSU was, and then LSU just continues to hurt themselves as well. I mean, the turnovers are really difficult. And that was my other concern going into this game, Tommy. I didn't know you were hoping that as an LSU fan that Nussmeier would bounce back from that performance against Texas A&M in the second half. But I was concerned a little bit about that, in that, you know, this is a guy going through this for the first time as a first-time starter, how he would bounce back. Can he just flush it? And I don't know. I think he's certainly someone now that's probably lost some confidence here, and they got to try to get him back right and get him in the right mental frame.
Definitely lost confidence. You know, to lose is one thing. To be embarrassed like that is another. And you can look at the Jalen Milroe thing where, you know, okay, maybe Texas A&M, you didn't know, you weren't prepared for that, but you had 2 weeks to prepare for this and you just couldn't stop it. I guess that being said, Alabama had 2 weeks to look at the Texas A&M film and learn from that, right?
Yeah, I think that was that's a little bit a part of it. I just think it just goes down to LSU at the line. But this was a game that they missed Harold Perkins. Mm-hmm. They missed a guy as a freakish athlete as he is. I think this was the game that they really, really missed him. I don't know if it would have made a difference in whether LSU would win the game or not, but there was just too many times that once Milroe got past the line of scrimmage, there wasn't a linebacker that could make a play on him. Certainly LSU safeties couldn't make a play on him, and that was really disappointing. And I mean, during the broadcast, in the fourth quarter, I think Kirk Herbstreit hit this point a lot. The talent is just simply not there. It's just not there for LSU at this point, and it's disappointing because it's year three, but a lot of the year three of the Brian Kelly era, and a lot of this, Tommy, goes back to decisions that were made when Brian Kelly was first hired, as far as who he had as his coaching staff, and not retaining a guy like Corey Raymond to make sure that you can continue the pipeline of great defensive backs coming into LSU. And
let me pick it up right there when
Brian Kelly decided to do something to go with a different person as your defensive backs coach and not retaining him and not making Frank Wilson your recruiting coordinator right off the bat. And those are things, it's just amazing that decisions that were made 3 years ago are still, this team is still, this program is still trying to catch up on.
We're going to take a break, pick it up right there, and we come back talking to Jeff Palermo, some excellent points. 7:21, traffic now, WWL. 7:25 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Jeff Palermo. WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director Tim Zimmer tells me that there is a scenario that LSU could be in the SEC championship game if they win out, if Georgia beats Tennessee, if South Carolina beats Missouri, and if Texas beats Texas A&M. Now, that to me is like a dog chasing a car. All right, you got it. What are you going to do with it? Tell me about LSU and Florida, with Florida coming up, I don't know anything about Florida's quarterback. Can he run?
Well, he's a third-string quarterback, Tommy, from Yale. He's a transfer from Yale.
So he's smart.
No, he's not Jalen Milroe. Can he run? No, this is a game that LSU should win. I was a little surprised looking at the point spread. I looked at it today. I think the Tigers are only favored by 4.5, 5.5 points, something like that. I mean, this is not a very good Florida team. I mean, they were uncompetitive. Well, heck, LSU was uncompetitive as well against Alabama, but Florida was the same way. This is a program that's got a lot of issues at this point. It appears that they're sticking with Billy Napier at least through the 2025 season. But this is a game. This is a get-right game, as they like to call it in football, or really in sports, when you're going through a tough time, and now you're taking on an opponent that you should be able to beat. So this is an opportunity for the defense to get a little more to get back on track, for Garrett Nussmeier to get back on track, try to establish a running game, give the ball to Caden Durham a few more times this Saturday and see what happens, so you can get a little bit more balanced on offense. Hopefully you can hit a big play with Chris Hilton. Just certain things that have been really lacking with this team. You got an opportunity to go into the swamp on Saturday afternoon and get those things accomplished.
Jeff, you know, I wanted to talk to you about this. It seems like when you talk about parity, especially with the big programs, the transfer portal, and if you look at the upsets that happen every weekend, I think, I guess you'd call them upsets, and the shakeups that go on among the top 10 teams, I think that's a result of the transfer portal and how you can get a lot better in a season, or maybe not so much. So what does Brian Kelly, he's in year three, and I'm looking at your story here of a 10-year contract? How much is it? $100 million? It's crazy.
Yeah, it's worth more than $100 million.
So how do you – I know you talked earlier about going back to the decisions that was made when he first came in. How does LSU catch up and try to turn this team around and get the talent that you're talking about that they don't have on defense right now?
Well, it's going to have to come through the transfer portal. They got a good recruiting class shaping up for 2025. It's going to be a top five recruiting class. But you also have to figure that it's going to take a couple of years for those guys to really become – I mean, there might be one or two guys out of that class that certainly make an impact on next year's team. But that class is not really going to really show, its strength or how well it is or how good it is until 2027, 2028. And LSU fans are not going to have that patience. So they're going to have to go big into the transfer portal. They're going to have to go in there and get about 7 or 10 players. And I'm talking about impact players. This past year, Tommy, in the offseason, they got about 4, right? I mean, Xavier Thomas is one of them. CJ Daniels is another one, but they didn't get Gio Paez is another one, but they didn't get a ton of, they're going to have to do better than that in the transfer portal this time around. They got to get about 7 or 10 players. I was watching the Ole Miss Georgia game, and Ole Miss looked so good on defense Saturday in Oxford against the Bulldogs. And a lot of these guys are transfer guys, transfer portal guys. And early on in the season, they weren't a unit yet. They weren't together just quite yet. But now they're playing like they should. And LSU's got to hit the transfer portal hard to try to turn this thing around quickly.
Thank you, Jeff. We'll talk to you again during the week. Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. Coming up, we'll take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street. Monday morning markets with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union, and what the economy could look like under the newly elected administration. 7:30, time for WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, honoring our veterans on Veterans Day. Meg Ferris texted in. Thank you, Meg. Her dad, Dr. Charles Ferris Jr., World War II in the Navy, who delivered God knows how many babies in this city. And we also want to honor and thank Captain Mark Rosa, who joins us now, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. I got that right, Captain?
Yeah, yes, sir. How are you this morning?
Oh, very, very good. I'm fine, and happy Veterans Day to you, and thank you for your service.
Well, thank you, Tommy. And proudly, I just want to say my dad was career military. That got me interested in enlisting, And he was from the 5th Special Forces Group, and he spent time in the 141st Field Artillery here in New Orleans. When I enlisted in the 141st Field Artillery here, went to officer school, and that's where I got my commission. My youngest brother, active duty Air Force, so we had a little bit of service in our family.
Well, outstanding. Thank all the roses for that. Let's talk about Wall Street and after the election and how Wall Street's reacted, and I'm just going to turn it over to you, Mark.
Tell me, they're calling it the Trump trade. Okay, so right before the election, it seems like, okay, the markets start backing up, meaning going down as far as the Dow, because they, you know, anticipate what's going to happen on the other side. So when all of the anticipation was kind of getting over and we realized which direction it was going, the Dow promptly went up by 1,500 points. That was a record. Covered this a little bit last week, but it's worth repeating. So we have, since the election day, the Dow was up 2,000 points. That was the ending last week, to a fresh record of 44,000. It was right at 42,000, and it finished right around 44,000. And this morning, pre-market, the Dow was up about another 192 at this moment. So 44,333 is where it would be if the market opened right now. And they're calling it the Trump trade. It was supported by, of course, the FOMC at the Fed met the next day and dropped interest rates by 25 basis points. That's a 75 basis point, 0.75% year-to-date action by the Fed. So the combination was very powerful. You know, those who picked the other side, they had some criers over the weekend. I was hearing from some analysts that said, well, we think the election's going to go the other way, and we're going to start shorting bank stocks, meaning that the bank stocks would be under pressure. They are crying in their soup this morning because they picked the wrong direction and they're going to suffer some losses. The bank stocks rallied as the financial companies are expected to do well under the Trump presidency, and we were covering this about a week or so ago. Energy, banks, and military related here on Veterans Day were saying that those sectors are going to appreciate the most under that. That's what's being forecasted right now. We're seeing that the banks have already rallied. But Tommy, I mean, it's just been good news. Now, if somebody said, do you think that the market is kind of overextended and getting ahead of itself? Yeah, I could see that because we're focused on the good. You know, the Fed has done some things this fall that we were expecting them to do. But 75 basis points is a far cry from what was expected earlier in the year. They have pulled back. I mean, some people were expecting two or three percentage points action this year, and they're only on 75 basis points. So they have one more meeting before the end of the year. That's December. It's expected that they are going to drop interest rates yet again by 25. So we'll have a full point this year. But again, a far cry from two or three. And interestingly enough, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, that's tracking the Fed movements and taking it, they're kind of predictors of what the Fed may do. It was going into 2025 with a slam dunk, definitely high percentage chances of more rate decisions, meaning more rate drops in January, going out to finish off the first quarter, more drops until March. All that's basically gone now. So it's like the economy is strong enough to stand on its own. I think the short-term rates in the market are still too high, speaking as a banker. I wish that would come down a bit to normalize the market. But I think it's some of this stuff is coming off so strong that it's on the news this morning that the Fed is worried. The Fed is worried about, well, you know, we do have some more work to do. We'd like to do it, but not if it's going to spark more inflation. And speaking of inflation, we have the CPI and PPI that's coming out this week for last month. Both are expected to be tamed. Both are expecting a 0.2% increase on the consumer price index for October and the producer price index for October. So that would put both of those at a 2.4% annual rate. That would be nice if they were a little bit lower than that. But the PPI for September came in at zero. So we take those, you know, you get to string a couple of those results together, and inflation is definitely better than it was a couple of years ago. But like you and I had talked about last week, I mean, I'd love the prices to start going down. And to do that, we need some negative numbers that come out of CPI and PPI. I don't know if we'll get them.
All right, hang on. Let me pick it up here when we come back, because I also want to talk to you about what the interest rate cuts mean for housing, Wall Street, the economy, 401ks, inflation, all that jumbled up in one puzzle. How do you sort it out, and where do the Venn diagrams overlap and all of that stuff? Because you want things to be good, but as I understand, you want them to be so good that it causes inflation. Again, Mark Rosa is here, our guest, Captain Mark Rosa, military family, president and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. Take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street and what the market and what the economy is likely to be like with the new administration that was elected last Tuesday. 751 traffic now, WWL. 757 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, on this Veterans Day. Captain Mark Rosa, a military family, is dad and brother, you said, Mark?
Yes.
Dad and brother served also. Yes. President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union, talking about the economy and the new Trump administration. And how do you are interest rates going to come down? Is that going to spur home building, home buying? How do you get people to enjoy the economy without inflation increasing, I guess, again, is what I'm trying to ask you.
Well, I guess that's a tightrope right now, Tom, because the forecast on interest rate decreases have lessened. So if anybody's interested, we had a tremendous amount of housing activity over the past couple of months as we got into the fall, because interest rates were expected to fall more than what they're expected to fall now. So a couple of people took advantage. We had a 5%-ish rate. It started with a 5 here in August, and then that backed up to 6% when some of that enthusiasm was coming out of the market. So, but I mean, for 6, if many people refinancing down from 8, so I would take that trade. You could look at Jefferson Financial, go and use the calculators free of charge, and you could see what the difference is, what your savings would be if you chose to refinance an existing loan. As far as the inflation, you know, Trump is saying that, you know, he wants to oust Jerome Powell from the Fed. He can't do that. He shouldn't have said something like that. That's why it's separate within the government, so they can evaluate the economy. That's what they do, and they could determine if rates need to go lower. But they don't want to bring them down and spark inflation again. That would, you know, would play this song all over again. So I think they need to be diligent about what they're doing, read the tea leaves properly as best they can. But the fact that the number of rate decreases have come out, you know, the expectation is maybe they are where they need to be, and they're going to lower in December and maybe stay away from it for a few months and see where the first quarter takes us. So interest rates and corporate earnings are good for stock prices. So we've got interest rates that are coming down in the down direction, at least. But 70% of them were still in earnings season. 70% of the companies that have reported, more to come out this week.
And I know you'll be watching it all for us, Mark. Thank you.
The holidays are all about sharing with family. Meals, couches, stories, grandma's secret pecan pie recipe. And now you can also share a cart with Instacart's family carts. Everyone can add what they want to one group cart from wherever they are. So you don't have to go from room to room to find out who wants cranberry sauce or who should get mini marshmallows for the yams or collecting votes for sugar cookies versus shortbread. Just share a cart and then share the meals and the moments. Download the Instacart app and get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes. Plus enjoy free delivery on your first 3 orders. Service fees and terms apply.
I'm Jed Lipinski. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
8:24 now, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Just when we thought Raphael was over with, there's something else down there that they're looking at, and Bridget Lim joins us now from the National Weather Service. How you doing, Bridget?
I'm fine, thank you. How about you?
I'm okay. Thanks for taking the time with us. Before we get to the tropics, let's talk about what's going on with the rain here and the rest of the week. What's that looking like?
Okay, so we do kind of have like the remnants of Raphael lurking in the area, and we will have some moderate rain chances as the week goes. So like, for example, today we'll have about 20%, and then it'll be kind of on and off through Thursday.
Kind of like drizzly, like it has been, almost not squally, because I guess it's not windy, but that kind of thing?
Yeah, like, you know, maybe your typical light to moderate showers. We're not expecting too many thunderstorms, at least.
So street flooding, not a real concern at this point?
So we aren't really too concerned with the coastal flooding because the winds are coming offshore now, so that should help flush some of the water that's been piling up the past few days.
And what about street flooding with the rain?
I can't 100% rule it out. Sometimes you'll just get like some that stay in the same place over and over, but that should be a relatively low risk.
Well, let's face it, it's New Orleans. There's always a risk of street flooding whenever it rains, right? What about beyond that? Beyond that, Bridget, with a cool front, can we look forward to any cool weather coming up?
We'll have cooler weather. We're still going to be a little bit, like, maybe closer to what would be normal, but we're still going to have highs in, like, the 80s after the cool front comes through and a couple days come by. So we'll have a little bit of it. So it's kind of like, you know, maybe a false fall kind of feel.
So what's happening with maybe Sarah or some area, an area in the, I guess that would be the, what is that, the Caribbean?
Yes, that's correct.
And what is going on down there, and what's likely to develop?
So right now, we're not worried about anything in the short term. We do have a 40% chance of formation in the next 7 days, so there's just a disturbed area in the Caribbean. Looking at the models, it looks like there may be something that's trying to form near Honduras, but I definitely just keep an eye on it. And right now, because of just like having cold fronts and all this other hostile environment for the hurricanes, I'm not too excessively worried about it coming to hit us anytime soon, but just something to keep an eye on.
What is the likelihood, even I'm going back to Milton now, of the conditions in the Gulf? And I know the wind shear decapitated Rafael, right? But the likelihood of anything like this, if it's called Sarah, I think would be the next name if it were to develop. Would that, I mean, are the conditions likely for anything to really develop or strengthen here, or is it a shoo-shoo?
So we do expect some kind of development. Like right now we have about a 40% chance in the next 7 days, so it's definitely possible. But like I said, the Gulf is going to be generally hostile, and we do have like cold fronts moving further south. That should help keep that at bay, but right now it's just a little too far out that I can't say with confidence.
So, on a scale of 1 to 10, as far as us watching this, being concerned with this, you'd put it where?
I mean, it's something to watch, but not something to, like, take, you know, tons of time out of your day. I give it, like, maybe a 3.
Okay, so it could develop into something?
Yeah, but I don't see it affecting Louisiana, at least in the next 7 days. It's something we just got to keep an eye on.
Okay. So I know, you know, there's a long time, and there's not even anything that it's a chance of tropical development. But I guess if something were to develop, what I'm trying to get to is this thing blowing up into anything like that, the Gulf is not favorable toward that at this time of year, correct?
Yes, that's correct. We might have, like, if it were to get into the Gulf, we may have, like, peripheral impacts, kind of like what we had with Rafael, but I would not expect anything too crazy, but it's something we still do have to keep an eye on.
Gotcha. And real quick, looking way up to Canada and the Arctic and all of that, do you see any real cold weather coming this way anytime soon?
Unfortunately, it's still we're still looking at above normal temperatures. Maybe in the further future, we'll have a little bit of better cold fronts. But yeah, at least for the foreseeable future, it's still going to be like this slightly above normal temperatures that we've been having.
And we're defining foreseeable future like a couple of weeks?
Like maybe next 7 to 10 days.
Okay. Thank you, Bridget. Anything I'm missing you wanted to bring up?
No, I think that's it for now. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I appreciate your time. Bridget Lim, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. We just wanted to keep you apprised of what's going on down there. The texts continue to pour in about our veterans as we honor them on this Veterans Day. I don't want to leave anybody out. I'm trying to get to as many as I possibly can. Lieutenant Leo James O'Rourke, Sergeant Lee Miles Godbold, Washington Artillery, killed in action in Iraq, 2005. I got to bring up also Brian Bates, who is a young man that I kind of adopted because he was buried in Westlawn Cemetery across from my parents, and I just happened to notice that he was killed in action on the day of my mother's birthday. So thank him for his service. Grandpa Frank Giolando, WWL Army cook, Dad Korean War gunny. My dad, Herbert Holder, U.S. Army, Europe D-Day. Happy Veterans Day to my big brothers, Kim Lacombe, Army Desert Storm, Shane Lacombe, Army, and my son, Matthew Lacombe, currently in the Marine Corps, so a family of service there. Deirdre Harris, Navy, Craig Harris, Matthew Harris, and Jessica Harris, Air Force. mom, dad, son, and daughter as a military family. And thank you to my late husband, Sergeant Leon Gabala, served in the Air Force during Vietnam. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Leslie Harris, a city council member, about what's passed with the election on Tuesday and what happens with homeless people from here on in. Right now it's time for WWL First News. 8:44:16 before 9 on this Veterans Day 2024. Leslie Harris joins us, New Orleans council member, talk about a thing that passed last Tuesday, a measure that was really, when it comes to affordable housing, is going to help a lot of veterans who constitute a considerable amount of homeless people. Good morning, Councilmember Harris. How are you?
Good morning. Happy Veterans Day.
And the same to you. Tell me about the percentage, or at least what your research, what your interaction, your personal experience has shown with veterans being homeless on the streets of New Orleans.
Yeah, we do have a lot of veterans who are homeless on our streets. A lot of people don't realize that we are home. New Orleans is home to a lot of veterans generally, which is a great thing. But we do experience veterans who are homeless. The VA does a lot of great work getting folks housed who are veterans, as does Bastion. And I just want to give a shout out to Bastion because they are a fantastic organization that focuses on housing veterans, veterans' mental health, and other services to people who have served. It's a great community, and the founder, Jackson, is an amazing person, and I hope to see him today at the World War II Museum.
And it's one thing, the reason I brought it up, Leslie, it's one thing, you know, say Happy Veterans Day and thank you for your service,
yeah,
but it's another thing to actually try to find somebody that served the country that's on the street and get them into a home.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And look, I come from a family of veterans. My grandfather served in World War II. My father served in Vietnam. I have countless cousins who have also served. And, you know, it really is, frankly, a difficult situation to come home from service and find yourself stranded and homeless. And I do think we have to take care of our men and women who have served our country. Again, I think our VA does great work, and there are other services that are aimed at veterans finding housing and getting the services that they need.
Why do you think the charter change passed so overwhelmingly last Tuesday?
Yeah, 75% of our voters voted for it. I think we had a great network of folks who were out there pounding the pavement, knocking doors, making sure that people understood what the charter amendment was for. So the Housing Trust Fund passed overwhelmingly. And it, again, I think New Orleanians understand the need for housing generally, but also the preservation of housing in our community. So I'm really thankful for everyone who voted for it, all of the volunteers and the folks who were really out there talking about it. And, you know, it was really a joyful time to celebrate that passage.
For people that don't know what exactly passed, take us through it, council member, if you would, please.
Sure. So what passed was a charter amendment to basically the New Orleans charter that 2% from here on out of the city's budget would go to affordable and workforce housing, both the creation and preservation of rental housing, but also the creation of home ownership opportunities for folks who are looking to be first-time home buyers, but also for folks who have homes that are falling into disrepair, programs to help them get their housing shored up, to fortify roofs. So really, it is just an overall investment in housing in the state of New Orleans. And again, 75% of our voters voted for it, and I think that's a fantastic thing.
So how do you create more rental properties or affordable rental properties?
Well, yeah, that's the way that we create it is to work with folks like People's Housing Plus and other investors to provide opportunities for housing and investment. And we have to really braid the funding together. So we look at federal funding. We look at state funding, but now we have a source of city funding that investors and developers can use in order to create affordable housing. This council, and I've said it before on with you, this council has invested over $49 million in gap financing for affordable housing. And it's really something that I'm proud that my colleagues have decided is worthwhile and worthy. But we are creating hundreds of new units for rental housing. And we know that our rental stock is falling into disrepair. And so new rental housing is critical to make sure that New Orleanians can stay in New Orleans.
So when you say you're a skilled, gifted attorney, Leslie, I'm not, and I'm trying to figure out, and you have vision and all that stuff, and I'm trying to figure out how do you create affordable housing? And are you talking about building new housing or changing what's now not affordable into? Take me through that, if you would.
Sure. It can be both. It can be building new housing. So there are new projects that are in the pipeline to build new rental housing and to build new housing. But there's also the opportunity to transform blighted properties into properties that can be used for rental. We look at the Louisiana Firehouse, for example, which is a city-owned property. And through partnership of NORA, Finance, New Orleans, People's Housing Plus, and a developer will be new rental units that come online as well as a child care center. But that's not the only thing that's going up. There's property that's city owned over near the French Quarter that New Orleans, NORA owns, that will be redeveloped into new rental property, an absolute new building. And again, that's through funding used from the city, property from the city, but also braiding city funding, federal funding, and state funding together in order to create brand new units for rental.
Let me sneak a break in, and we'll talk about NORA when we come back and what the administration of this 2% looks like that the voters approved. At least 2% of the city's annual budget, starting in 2026, goes into that fund. We're talking to Leslie Harris, New Orleans City Council member, about providing affordable housing. And again, veterans sometimes are homeless, and it's not just for veterans. It's for people that really are the lifeblood of the city's economy when it comes to service workers. 8:51 now, 9 till 9, traffic, WWL. 8:56 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Leslie Harris, our friend, New Orleans City Council member, talking about affordable housing and the charter amendment that passed by 75% or with 75% of the vote last Tuesday. Let me read this text to you, council member. It says, what about the people in the middle? It seems most of these places, your income has to be significantly low, but affordable housing should be for everyone. What about the person who makes a decent income but still finds $1,900 too much for rent? There's a lot packed in there with, you know, I don't know what they determine to be a decent living, but then that goes to what you're spending your money on, et cetera, et cetera. How do you parse all of that?
Yeah, well, I think it's a supply and demand issue. If we have more supply of housing, which the housing trust fund will create, then the amount of rent should go down. So I really do think it's a supply and demand issue. I know that rent is very high. I know that home prices are very high in New Orleans. And we know from a study that was commissioned by the mayor that the majority of New Orleanians are rent or house burdened, meaning they are spending the majority of their income on rent or their housing payments. So again, I think it's a supply and demand problem. We need to create more housing, both affordable and workforce. So the people who are working, our teachers, our police officers, our firefighters, need to have a place that's affordable. And I think by having and passing the housing trust fund, we're going to create that housing.
Do you have a sliding scale or something, or how do you determine who qualifies for this, or is it that far along yet?
It's So what we have done is passed an ordinance that effectuates the housing trust fund. We did not, and intentionally, we did not include what the federal guidelines are for affordability to allow for that sort of sliding scale and to address the missing middle, the folks who are making a decent income but who still can't afford to make rental payments or who can't afford down payments for a home. So we very much intentionally did not include the 80 to 120 AMI, which is the federal guideline, so that we could determine based on what the economy of the time looks like so that we could address those folks who are in the middle.
Is there a way for people to go online, find out more about this, or is this a work in progress? How do they do it, Leslie?
Sure. I certainly will post on our social media more information, and then they can also go to NOLAHousing.com and get more information.
Effectuates, huh? Now you're showing off. Just kidding. Have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you, Tommy. Bye-bye.
Leslie Harris, New Orleans City Council. Remember, we're going to take a break. We come back. We're going to take a deep dive into illegal immigration and the immigration system in the United States. Well, we've seen the Biden administration. What are we likely to see in the new Trump administration? And I want you all to get involved here. 504-260-1870. If you have any questions or comments, none of them are dumb when it comes to immigration because none of us know it all. We'll be back. WWL. SEC championship game is the favorites winning out in Arkansas, upsetting Missouri, who is at best average, and then LSU goes to Atlanta, and I guess you'd see what happens from there. But, of course, first things first, you got to figure out what the hell happened on Saturday night and fix that. Now let's move on to immigration. If you have any questions or comments about the immigration problems that we have in this country, please text them to 504-260-1870. That's the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and Text Line. There is so much misinformation and disinformation out there. I thought we'd spend an hour with David Beer, Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato Institute, and take a deep dive into it, what we've seen under the Biden administration, what we've seen under the previous Trump administration, and what we're likely to see in the next Trump administration. And with that, we welcome in David Beer. How you doing, David?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for taking the time. So let's start, I guess, with Immigration 101. If somebody wants to come to the United States from another country, what is the proper process for them to do that?
Well, it really depends. If you're marrying a U.S. citizen, it's pretty straightforward. Depending on whether you've ever broken immigration law before. If you have, then it's going to be a problem. If you haven't, then it's pretty much a straightforward process. It might take a couple years to get through, but it's, you have a path there. If you're a more extended family member, a brother or sister, an adult child who's trying to immigrate, you're going to be waiting at least a decade, if not two or three decades, for the chance to immigrate through those processes. If you're being sponsored by an employer, I don't have enough time to explain to you all the regulations that they place on employers trying to hire foreign workers. It is extensive. The bottom line is you're looking at a three-year process, and it's extremely costly to the employer. So unless you are a very high wage worker, odds are you're not getting through the employer sponsored immigration system. And even if you do, you're looking at a very long wait time before you can come because of not only the processing, but then the cap. So you have to wait for a cap spot to become available. For many people, you're again looking at a decade wait to get in through that process. So then you have a lot of temporary visas kind of picking up the slack for this really outdated and bureaucratic processes for coming to the United States. And so you have the H-1B visa for temporary high-skilled workers. That's a lottery. You have 85,000 slots. You got 300,000 people applying typically. Again, odds aren't great on that one. And then for low-skilled folks, you have the H-2A and H-2B visas. These are only for seasonal jobs in seasonal agriculture for the H-2A or seasonal non-agriculture for the H-2B. So those are your pathways, and they're quite limited, and exclude most of the jobs in our economy are not jobs that don't even qualify for these temporary visas.
Say that part again about the jobs in the economy don't qualify?
Most of the jobs in our economy don't have a temporary work visa at all available to them, because for the low-skilled guys, you're only talking about the seasonal jobs being available at all. And then you have the H-1B for high-skilled, so that's only for bachelor's and above. Most of the jobs in our economy don't require a college degree, so they're not eligible for the H-1B. Most of them aren't seasonal jobs or temporary jobs, so those are all excluded. So most jobs in construction, dairies, meat packing and processing, these are the types of jobs that are just systematically excluded from our legal immigration system.
Give me an example of a seasonal agricultural would be, I guess, like picking fruit, right?
Yeah, so a lot of it's apples up in Washington. You're looking at peaches in Georgia. So a lot of that type of very labor-intensive agriculture requires a lot of workers, and they come in on a seasonal basis. The non-seasonal stuff is going to be the dairies, a lot of the livestock. You know, that's just, you need somebody all year round to do that job. And for those people, unfortunately, they're out of luck through our current immigration system.
So who is doing those jobs? Wait, they're out of luck with the seasonal non-agricultural. Yeah. Why? Yeah. Because they're out of luck? Why are they out of luck?
They're out of luck because it's a year-round job. And the government says you have to have it has to be a seasonal job to qualify for those visas. Who is doing those jobs? Well, it's a lot of the people who are crossing the border illegally and coming in, and either they're just blending into the population and borrowing identification to apply for a job, but many of them apply for asylum, which opens up the opportunity to get a work permit temporarily and apply for any job they like through that procedure.
All right, let me go back to illegal immigrants that are working at the meatpacking plants and the non-seasonal jobs.
Yeah.
Why aren't Americans doing those jobs?
Well, if you look at the labor force participation rate, the employment rate for prime age Americans, it's about 81-82% of the population, which is near a record high. And so then the other people who are in that 25 to 54 age range, most of them, there's some retirees. Of course, there are a lot of wives and other parents at home with their children. And so that's where you're really not going to get that much higher than that. And so when jobs become available, they're looking for higher paying, higher, better quality jobs. I mean, these are not the highest quality jobs in our economy. And so, they're preferring other jobs to agriculture, to dairy. This type of work is just not meat packing. I mean, this is really grueling work that they're, there are better options out there. It's really the short answer for why Americans aren't applying for these jobs.
All right, let me ask it a different way. If it were not for, as I understand it, the people, and I'm not making a case either for or against, I'm just asking, if these people were not in a country illegally filling these jobs, what would happen then to the companies that are using these people that are here illegally? Or are they here legally and then they apply? Take me through that part, David, because I'm confused.
Yeah. It's not entirely clear what you call them. Most people call them illegal immigrants, but many of them are here with government permission. They're waiting for an application in some asylum proceeding, and so they have work authorization. They can work legally while their case is going through the courts. And so, from the employer's perspective, they're legal. They're not doing anything wrong by hiring them. And so, if they weren't there, they would shrink production. Really what these workers allow these companies to do is produce more chicken or milk or whatever the case might be. And that's a benefit to us as consumers because they're producing more than they otherwise would. If they, if production decreased enough, of course, Americans would resort to importing a lot of these products from other countries as long as that's an option available to them.
When you said they, while they wait for their case to be heard, case to apply to be a permanent worker or a permanent immigrant worker, not necessarily a case of persecution or anything, right? Or what's the word I'm thinking of?
Asylum.
Asylum.
A case, you know, protection from persecution, torture. Yeah. So for the, in those cases, yeah, it's pretty much, if you have a work authorization, then you probably applied for asylum because that's the trigger to be able to apply for work authorization. Now, there's a whole other group of people who have been let into the country legally through parole, which is basically a discretionary status that the executive branch can grant to people for humanitarian reasons. Those people also have work permits who can work legally as a result of that. And so those people might not be waiting for a case at all. They just entered legally and have work permits. And, you know, this is really something that the Biden administration has leaned on as an alternative to just letting those people enter illegally. They've created these legal ways for them to come. And it's really kind of outside of the normal immigration systems that I'm talking about, which is, you know, the family reunification, employer sponsorship, and temporary work permit path. And so they've used those quite significantly at the border and for five countries, Cuba, Nicaragua, Haiti, and Venezuela, as well as Ukraine. Those five countries have ways for people to come directly so they don't have to show up at the border. But those people who come in, they get work permits as well under parole and can work legally through those systems. If you don't have that, if you just cross the border illegally and you didn't apply for asylum, then you're working illegally. There's no option for you in that case.
Let me take a break and try to digest some of this, David. I got people texting in. I want to get their questions in as well. The Oakwinard Jeweler Talking text line's open at 504-260-1870. It is a complicated process. A couple of things from the notes I took. People that are trying to get family in that are not a spouse, you're saying they're waiting two or three decades, so the people that are coming into the country illegally are basically cutting a line in front of people that are trying to do it the right way and wait two or three decades. Is that accurate or not?
That's absolutely true.
Okay.
Yes.
And also, when you say parole, and we'll pick it up there, we come back with the Biden administration, that's not necessarily because of the word, the definition of the word parole, that's not necessarily linked to criminal activity on the part of the person in the country, or is it?
Right. Yeah. Parole in the immigration context just means kind of a temporary release into the United States, similar to, you know, release from prison, but they mean a completely different thing. It has no relationship to criminal activity or even illegal crossing into the country. That's right.
Let's pick it up there. We come back talking to David Beer, Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato Institute. We're going to spend an hour on this because I think, you know, if we're going to have a discussion about it, we may as well know what the hell we're talking about. It can't hurt, right? 504-260-1870. It is an extremely convoluted process, so there are no dumb questions. Feel free to text them in. I'll pass them along to David. When we come back, Tommy Tucker, WWL. All righty, we're spending an hour taking a deep dive into immigration, and David Beer, our guest, who is with the Cato Institute, the Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato Institute, said he didn't have enough time to tell us about one facet or the other, and I think we could talk about this for like a week and still not understand it all, maybe if we did PowerPoints and took notes and all of that. Somebody texted in and said, there's 1.1 million individuals that fit the criteria that David's talking about right now. They're working in this country legally for farming and agricultural jobs. There is no shortage of individuals. These conditions, I don't think you were saying that there's a shortage of people that are in the country that are immigrants working the jobs. You're saying there's a shortage of Americans that would do those jobs, correct? David, do you have me on mute, perhaps? David Beer, Cato Institute, do you have me on mute, perhaps? David Beer, do you have me on mute? Apparently we have a problem. Tim, maybe we can call him back, see what happened, and maybe get him back on the line and see what's going on with the immigration situation here, because people are texting in. Somebody texted in and said these so-called immigrants saved us after Katrina. Well, they are immigrants. They're from the other country, but I do understand what you're saying. So, David, what I was asking you is, somebody texted in about individuals that meet the criteria. You're talking about working in a country legally for farming and agricultural. There's no shortage, but you're not saying there's a shortage of people that are in a country legally working the jobs. You're saying there's a shortage of Americans that would do these jobs, correct?
Yeah, that's right. It's both. I mean, if you look at what the job openings are, I mean, we're still higher than pre-pandemic, even after all the people have come in. The number of job openings, 8 million, unemployment, 4%. If you look at these industries, I mean, really, they've been facing difficulties finding people, whether immigrant or not, for really the last 4 years.
So another text says Americans would do those jobs if the pay was higher, but they have low pay, which draws the illegals to them because that's the only job they can get. Well, if the jobs paid more, well, then everybody, that would be passed along through the economy, right, and higher prices. And that kind of brings us to the border, pardon the pun, of tariffs and buying American. Accurate or not?
Yeah, but you have to think about what Americans are doing right now. I mean, you can't think about, okay, yes, more Americans would do agricultural work if there were no immigrants here. And that's true. If we have, I mean, 50% of the agricultural labor force gets deported in the next 4 years, you will end up with more Americans doing it. Higher, the wages will go up a little bit, but ultimately, yes, that'll get passed on to the consumer. But even more important than that, you have to think about what were those Americans doing right now? Well, they have jobs right now. As I mentioned, the employment rate for Americans is 82%. It's basically at record highs. So those Americans are going to go from doing jobs that are higher paying, higher productivity jobs into agriculture, which is lower productivity and lower wages. And so you're not even benefiting the Americans who are going to ultimately be forced into those jobs as jobs get lost. So you lose the jobs that are downstream from whatever the immigrants are doing. So the immigrants are the ones who are picking the crops, and the Americans are the ones being managers or in charge of shipping and whatever the case.
You're talking about with the produce, with the agricultural companies, right? I'm trying to follow you, David. So
yeah.
You're saying that, okay, so you got XYZ cauliflower company, and is President-elect Trump talking about deporting the people that are here working legally with work visas, the HB, whatever it was?
No, he's not talking about deporting the people who are here legally. But there are lots of people who are in the field here illegally. And, you know, there are a lot of, you know, people working on farms that are not seasonal here also here
and
illegally.
And packing plants and those kind of things, right?
Yeah, I mean, and look at construction. Construction is a good example of this. If you look at construction, immigrants who come in, they're about six times more likely to be doing the unskilled jobs at the construction site compared to Americans construction laborers, right? And whereas the skilled jobs, the more specialized work, that's much more likely to be done by the U.S. citizen workforce. And so there's a complementarity there. So the immigrants are doing the less skilled jobs and lower paid, lower productivity stuff, and the Americans get to do higher paid, higher productivity jobs, which would be lost if these lower paid workers are deported.
All right, so I got Tucker Farms, okay? And I grow all kinds of stuff, and I depend on illegals to process a lot of it because if I were to pay Americans to do it, the consumers would revolt and I would have stuff maybe going bad on the shelves or consumers couldn't afford it. So if the President-elect Trump were to deport these illegals that are working here now, I would have to take people from Tucker Farms and management positions and get them to do the picking because I couldn't find other Americans to do the jobs for what it would pay?
Absolutely. And we've experimented with this. We've seen this when sweeps have happened and taking people out. You see the farmer and his children, they're out in the fields, they're trying to do as much as they can, and they still can't cover all of the crops that are lost. And so, yeah, we've seen this play out multiple times in the past. Many experiments have been done here, and Americans either completely don't shift or not nearly enough apply for these open jobs, and that results in lower productivity, less stuff making it to the shelves, and ultimately lower paid work for American workers.
So let's talk about the former president's plan and the what it would take to pull off what he's talking about with deporting the illegals that he said. What did he say in his campaign? He would deport whom?
He said, I mean, he didn't put a limit to it.
He said mass
deportation. He ran on mass deportation, which implies it's indiscriminate, that it's not limited to any particular category of person who's in the country illegally. It's anybody who's removable, and he's going to make a lot more people removable as well, people who have legal status now under, you know, the Biden administration's different policies. Are going to lose that legal status and enter the illegal category.
I want to get back to Biden in a minute. Let's talk about President-elect Trump. If this were to happen, what do we have the personnel to do that right now? Whatever law enforcement agencies would be needed? Are people in place that could? What would that look like? I guess is what I'm saying. You study this for a living. What would mass deportation actually look like? On an everyday level, on the street, here or there, wherever.
Look, it's not like this guy wasn't president before, mm-hmm. and it's not like he had different policy. I mean, in his first term, there was no limits placed on immigration and customs enforcement agents. They could arrest whoever they wanted. And we didn't end up with, you know, 10 million people being deported. So I don't know where the kind of, you know, fantasy land proposals come from. I think that if the administration comes in here with the military and starts putting up roadblocks all over the country, trying to, you know, shake down every driver's papers, yeah, that's going to round up a lot of people and scare a lot of people off. But I also don't think it's likely. I don't think he's going to do those kind of things because we still have civil liberties in this country. We still respect rights in this country. And so, yeah, I think it's going to look a lot like his first term, maybe with more money, more men, more manpower. But, you know, it's really, if you look at it, President Obama deported a lot more people than Trump did during his 4 years. And, you know, on an annualized basis, you know, not even looking at the 8 years that Obama had. So, again, I'm skeptical that he can do something that's radically different from what we saw in the first term. And, you know, it's not a difference in policy. There will be a difference in focus. I think he will get more money and more help from Congress this time. But at the end of the day, you do have to go out and find people. And that's the hard part. There's no way to just look at someone and say, you're here legally, and I know it. You have to prove it, and that's a lot easier said than done.
Somebody texted and said 73 million people agree with Donald J. Trump. We never had a problem with workers 5 years ago in the field. Why would we have a problem now? And that's a nice talking point to type up there, but what they're missing is that he didn't do 5 years ago what he is at least promising to do now. Accurate?
Right, exactly. He didn't actually accomplish his goal last time. He knows that, which is why he's you know, asking for more money. He's talking about taking money from the military to pay for it. I mean, these are the types of things that are on the table exactly because it didn't happen last time. And I would beg to differ with the caller on the struggles that farmers were facing in 2019. There were extreme problems that they were having. They were producing a lot less agriculture and food for us than they would have otherwise had immigration, legal immigration, been easier. And so, yeah, it's correct to say he didn't accomplish this last time. I don't think he will this time, but if he did, it would be a much different economic analysis.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up here when we come back. You can work on this text when we come back. Wait, agricultural workers, from my understanding, are almost here legally under H-2A visas. Large agricultural interests are not employing illegals, as to do so would risk their businesses. You can address that when we come back. 940, 20 till 10, traffic now, WWL. Hi, David Beer is our guest, 948, 12 till 10. He's the director of immigration studies at the Cato Institute. So where were we, David? I read that text to you, and I was going to ask you to address it about, go ahead,
yeah,
about the employee and illegals and H-2As and all that stuff.
Right. So in agriculture, it's really split between seasonal and non-seasonal, like I mentioned. In non-seasonal, you're not eligible for the H-2A, so you're going to be hiring whoever comes down the street. Even in the H-2A program, though, you're required to hire people who, on paper, look like U.S. workers. And if I'm an illegal worker and I borrow my ID from my brother who's got citizenship or whoever I get from the black market, I'm required to hire that person ahead of hiring the person through the H-2A program. And so there are lots of people who are hired who are, in fact, here illegally, who the employer doesn't know they're here illegally, or you know, can't prove that they are, so they have to hire them through those means. So yeah, it's difficult out there if you're an employer. You might want to do everything legally. You might want to totally avoid the illegal market, and you really can't help it at the end of the day.
I don't know how you can, from what you're saying, with the waiting periods and the what would make sense? How did we get to where we are now? I wanted to get back to the Biden administration. What has happened since Joe Biden took office with the immigration situation?
Yeah, I mean, a lot. Obviously, a lot has happened. You know, mainly it's people crossing the border illegally in great numbers. We've had, obviously, almost 10 million people come to the southwest border. Some of them multiple times. They've been turned away and they come back again. Many of them have been released. Over 4 million at this point have been released into the United States. And many of them, about half, you know, a quarter are children, about half are already working in the United States. So if they're going to prioritize the most recent arrivals, you know, that's what it pretty much looks like.
So just so people understand, if you're born here, you are a U.S. citizen, correct?
Yes. If you're born here, you're guaranteed U.S. citizenship.
So if there are people here that were born here whose parents were illegals and you deport the illegals, then the illegals would either have to choose to take their children with them, or you would have to provide some kind of care for the children, because that you can't deport a U.S. citizen for no reason, can you?
Yes, you cannot deport a U.S. citizen. It would be up to the parents whether they bring their kids with them or not. Some do, some don't. There's certainly a lot of U.S. citizen kids growing up in Mexico whose parents were deported from the United States over the last 20 years. So it is something that happens. Some stay with relatives because, you know, ultimately the opportunity is much better here in the United States than it is in their home countries.
So when they get to be adults, these kids that went back with their parents, they are U.S. citizens and they have documentation, so they can come into the country or not?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there are a lot of hundreds of thousands of kids in Mexico. And young adults as well who have U.S. citizenship and can come back to the United States whenever they want, when they're adults.
David, again, we could talk about this for a week, I think, and give PowerPoints and notebooks and handouts and you know, the sheets with the plastic that lay over the other sheets and everything. But when it comes to before you start deporting people, and I think you and I had this discussion last week, and I'm not trying to be flippant about it, but until you secure the border, this is just a futile exercise because we're talking about Fred Flintstone putting a cat out of the window at night, right?
Yeah, you have people flying out, people coming in. I think everyone agrees. Donald Trump was elected to secure the border and remove the criminal elements who've come in. Beyond that, I think those are the priorities. Or should be the priorities for the next administration.
So we only got 2 minutes left. What, in your opinion, does a secure border look like? Because that, to me, is the first step. Until you do that, you're just peeing up a rope. You're not accomplishing anything.
Yeah, I mean, a secure border, you got to start with, of course, the Border Patrol and their ability to make arrests and detain people. But you also have to focus on the legal immigration side, which we've been discussing. I mean, if you have a legal path that's realistic, that, you know, employers in the U.S. understand and the workers understand, then that's a game changer, because then people are, okay, I'm willing to wait if there's a realistic chance that, you know, I can come, I see my family member come. Maybe I don't even bring my family. I just go on my own if there's a legal way to come. I don't need to. So you decrease the number of arrests by four by letting one person come in and work for a while in the United States if their spouse and their kids stay at home. I mean, that's the situation in, you know, large parts of Mexico that have been benefiting from the H-2A guest worker visa. It's just all these jobs that aren't eligible for that seasonal agricultural visa.
David, I think I'm going to ask you to come on every week. We ought to have Immigration 101 every week until we get through this, really, because it's not going to go away. It is a big problem. There are no simple solutions, and there's never enough time to cover it. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Of course.
David Beard, bye. Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato Institute. Good luck. 9:54, 6 till 10. We'll find out what Noel's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.
I'm Jed Lipinski. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.